This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Chris McHugh joins me live in studio. Until recently, an executive at Ford. He also worked at General Motors. And it's an honor to welcome you to the studio. How are you?
Thanks, Coy. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be here.
Glad you're here. I've really been looking forward to this because you and I, of course, have had conversations off the air about this topic, and this is great to be able to share some of your insight and your experience with the auto industry with the listeners here in Central Virginia, because I personally believe that this is really valuable stuff, that what you've seen, what you've literally lived through as an executive at Ford is priceless when it comes to helping Americans understand the headlines. When we see these headlines and these news stories about the executives going to Washington in their jets and then going in their cars and trying to get money to get bailed out to, and it's fascinating. And here in Virginia, you know, this isn't Northern Michigan, so we don't have a huge manufacturing culture. It's not an auto industry state. We just don't. We're so removed from it. We don't really understand it. So thank you for being here to help us make sense of it. And we want to invite folks at any time, of course, if you want to join the conversation. It's 977-1070. Chris, let's start with a Chris McHugh 101. Just give us a little bit about your background and how you actually ended up being one of those guys in the suits who's at the big tables at Ford and making these big decisions.
Sure. Well, I was born in Detroit. And grew up going to school always with the intention of working my entire life for one of the big three. Mother worked there, brother, sister, mother-in-law. So it's very ingrained in that culture. I went to University of Michigan, and during grad school, I thought it was odd that the other students that were there weren't interested in staying in Detroit to work in the industry. That was my first wake-up call that, oh, maybe there's something else out there outside of the auto industry. But it was never my intention to leave Michigan, obviously. So all my studies were directed towards that. Started at General Motors when I was in grad school for engineering, and started out as an intern. And had a variety of assignments in various operations at GM, and ended up in a unit that was eventually spun off as Delphi. So I actually have some experience with the Delphi corporation, and then left at the end of the 90s in 99 and went to Ford, and kind of worked my way up the chain in Ford, always in operations management. So most of my experience is with the actual manufacturing process and the management of the facilities.
Right, right. You were one of the executives who was actually involved in the making of the cars.
Yes,
absolutely. Not necessarily the design or payroll. Or, I mean, just literally, we're going to make this stuff.
And right, right.
And what kind of floor space do we need? What machines do we need? How many people do we need? All this, these decisions.
Yep.
So tell us about the auto industry today. For me, and I know I speak for many people here in Virginia, when we see Ford, GM, and Chrysler, they're just names, and we can sort of picture some of the products that they make. But help us understand the differences between the big three. Because I know you've told me before, there's like huge differences. They're very different. And so you grow up in Michigan sort of knowing these things, but
right.
What are the differences?
Well, you know, in a big picture, there's not that many differences between the three companies. They have very similar mentality on manufacturing, but their histories are pretty diverse. They grew up all around the Detroit area, but in the beginning, Ford, of course, was the largest anti-union company of the three. They've since changed, and in recent decades, the last two decades, they've been the most, I won't call them pro-union, but they've had the least cantankerous negotiations with the UAW. GM, on the other hand, which really General Motors started out as a collection of many different smaller automotive companies, has grown into just a huge juggernaut of manufacturing, and they typically today have the most cantankerous agreements with the UAW. Chrysler has always been the smallest of the three corporations, and of course they already went through one bailout package about 20 years ago. So you know, they're kind of the weakest one. They have the oldest technology in their facilities. They haven't upgraded their facilities like the General Motors and Ford has. So some of the differences today in the companies are Ford tended to stick with designs that were less controversial, more tried and true.
Yeah.
And they really were pushing for the improved quality to compete with the Japanese, which today, if you look at, for example, J.D. Power, the top 10 list in certain segments, Ford has several vehicles on that list. So today they can and do compete and actually outperform some of the Japanese companies for quality. So that's refreshing because it wasn't always that way. You asked about that earlier when we were talking about their quality levels. The truth is, in the 70s and the 80s, the quality was terrible. No doubt about it. It was
for Ford.
For all of them.
American cars.
For American cars in general. There's probably some people out there that are getting angry hearing me say that, but that's just the truth. And as the Japanese companies applied their lean manufacturing concepts to it, elimination of waste and defects is one of the top wastes that they seek to eliminate. And they've done a very good job doing that. They've practiced that, Toyota, since the end of World War II. And they're reaping the benefits of it now. Of course, they're having a rough year like everyone else.
Yeah, yeah.
But in general, they've done a very good job. So their quality is very high. Now Ford competes with it. GM, I think, is closing the gap. I think Chrysler is still a mile away as far as their quality. Yeah.
So of the three, Chrysler's in the worst shape?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Another point with Chrysler is their marketing strategy has been more for the quick, flashy sell. And, you know, unlike the GMs and the Fords, which are more of the Taurus, the SUVs, the solid performers, the Cadillac line, they haven't changed them as much. So Chrysler's in trouble.
We're talking with Chris McHugh, a former executive at Ford and GM. We're honored to have him here in the studio to give us some perspective on this bailout. So let me just ask you a very open-ended question. When you watch the news and see the headlines and you see these executives go to Washington with their hands out, and what are you thinking? As a former executive yourself, what are your thoughts about this whole bailout that's going on?
Well, it's very alarming. You know, I have a lot of family members that still work in the big three, including Chrysler and Ford and GM, all three of them. And so when I watch it, it's pretty gut-wrenching because there's literally hundreds of thousands of people and families that depend on the profitability of that industry in the United States. And on one hand, so I feel for them. You know, I watch it. I'm always watching what's going on, although I no longer work in automotive.
Yeah.
But you can't take that away. You know, it's ingrained, and so I feel for them. On the other hand, it's kind of it was embarrassing when the leaders of the big three went to Washington. They had no plan to bring their companies to solvency. They basically, you know, like you mentioned, they flew there on their jets. That left a bad taste in everyone's mouth.
Yeah.
It was sad. So for the government to have to step in and say, guys, if you want our help, you better come with a plan to make your company profitable, that's embarrassing. It really is.
I mean, isn't this so, like something you learn as a first-year MBA? Is you need a business plan
if you
want somebody to give you money?
Yeah, yeah. Exactly right. If you're going to start a new business or to expand a business and you're going to a bank for a loan, you better have a business plan that's pretty solid. And they did not.
Yeah.
So that part of it I found pretty embarrassing. You know, the union, the response from Mr. Gettelfinger.
Who is who?
He is the president of the UAW.
Okay.
So they, of course, have represented employees in all three of the big three and all the supply base. You know, in the beginning, he was very much not willing to make any concessions. Did not surprise me in the least. We can talk at length about the unions.
Yeah, and we will.
The unions,
we're not going to let you leave here today without getting your thoughts about the role of the unions in this whole thing.
But, you know, he's since had to kind of turn his tune a little bit and come to the table as well.
Yeah.
So I think now, you know, when the pressure really gets turned up, that's when you're going to see some results happen. But until then, I think it's going to be status quo.
We're talking with Chris McHugh, a former executive at Ford and GM. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to continue this conversation on the other side. You're listening to Charlottesville Right Now. Well, I guess we're not going to take that quick break. We have an issue with the computers. Maybe somebody can get in here and fix them. We're going to continue our conversation with Chris McHugh, who was, until recently, a former executive at Ford and also worked for General Motors. Let's talk about the unions, and let's talk about the good and the bad, because you can't be an executive at an auto industry and not deal with unions.
Right.
I mean, everybody's part of a union, aren't they? All the people that work for you, aren't they all part of the union?
All of the folks that work in the plants that actually build the vehicles are all unionized employees. The management team is not union, of course. They can't be. So that's kind of the difference. The salaried team would be non-union. The only exception to the rule there is Chrysler's engineers are unionized as well. You know, the union, going back in history, they certainly had a very relevant place at the early part of the last century, where the working conditions were terrible, safety was not a consideration in the workforce. The labor practices were ridiculous, like we see today in many third world countries.
Yeah.
Today, however, you know, the relevancy of the unions have really almost become minimal, nominal, in fact, because of the federal labor laws that are in place. Many OSHA restrictions that I deal with are much more stringent than anything the unions would put forth in any of the major facilities. So, you know, today, the relevancy of the union isn't there. And so that's a big obstacle that's going to need to be overcome, is you now have an organization that is parasitic, really, off the profits of the auto industry, and yet serves very little purpose today. So that's a big issue that they're going to have to overcome.
And talk about, because I know we've talked before about, we're talking with Chris McHugh, a former executive at Ford. The salaries that the union folks make, even when they're not working, is stunning.
Yeah.
I mean, get me a job.
Yeah.
It is amazing what they get paid not to work.
Yeah, well, that's a trick, getting a job in there, because that's a whole nother topic in itself, is how do you get into a union position. But there's two major issues. You've got the wage scale of the UAW, and then you've got the work rules that are put in place in the contracts. And both of these are very relevant when you talk about how do we make the big three competitive on a global scale. One, the wage structure that you mentioned. I had employees that, you know, some of my skilled trades folks, they would easily be making, you know, $30 an hour straight time. But their benefits were outstanding, where, you know, maybe today you have, in many manufacturing, you might have an additional 50% over their straight time wages is benefits, right? Well, they were more like an additional 100% or 150% in benefits. So right there, you can say, wow, I mean, compared to the rest of the country, you know, they had fantastic benefit structure, much better than the salaried employees, by the way. It was not, you know, what the union got in the old day used to be the salaried people got, okay?
Yeah.
That's no longer the case. The salaried people, a lot of that had been stripped away over the last 20 years. But not so in the union-represented employees, because they have to be negotiated.
Yeah.
So.
And that, of course, is part of the problem, is it not? When you have to sustain this really... some might argue artificially inflated pay scale for the folks who work on the line and the union employees. When you're just talking about how to save this industry from a business perspective, if you start with the fact that you got to pay these people, and then all the people that are retired that you have to pay at a huge rate, makes it very challenging.
Yeah, they have two major challenges in the cost side. I mean, they have fixed and they have variable, and the variable is the hourly labor we've been talking about. Very expensive. Let me give you an example. When we did some of the, in the early part of this century, we went through some layoffs at Ford, and they went into what we called a gen pool at the time. And now this is where, although they're laid off, they get their layoff benefits, but then the company makes up the difference between what they're receiving from unemployment up to 95% of their normal wage that they would have gotten had they worked a 40-hour work week.
So they get laid off,
yeah,
but the company still needs to keep paying them.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So why lay them off?
Well,
to save that 5%.
Here's where it gets tricky. The plant managers on their profit and loss, okay, when they laid these people off, the difference in the pay that they got came from the corporation, not from the plant. So it would make the plant's books look good. They took action. They right-sized the business. They were managing the business.
And you bump the cost upstairs.
You bump the cost upstairs. So as a corporation, we weren't getting the benefit of doing these layoffs. Okay? So the managers, yeah, they were managing at the plant manager level. But up the ladder, you're still paying that difference.
And don't they have to, like, still come to work and sit in a room? I mean, what is that story?
Oh, man. That, we did had a number of people in the gen pool where we actually had them report to work 8 hours a day and basically had to sit in a large room with a supervisor and do nothing all day long.
And that was to ensure that they weren't getting money from Ford while they were laid off and then going getting another job.
Right. That was exactly right.
Amazing.
Yeah. Amazing. It was amazing.
And you have to look at that. As an educated guy who understands business, you have to look at that and say, this industry's broken.
Yeah.
Something's wrong.
Yeah.
A lot of things are wrong.
A lot of things.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about that. What's really wrong and what really could be done to fix the American auto industry. We're talking with Chris McHugh, a former executive at Ford and GM. A break here at the bottom of the hour for local news and weather. More with Chris McHugh on the other side. This is Charlottesville Right Now. Let's rejoin our conversation with Chris McHugh. He's a former executive at Ford and also worked at General Motors. And Chris, the bailout, these billions of dollars that the big three have, looks like they've gotten now from me and you and, yeah. And the rest of us. What's it for? What's it mean? And is it going to do anything? I mean, is it really going to help address these problems, which we want to get into a little bit more in this half hour?
Okay, well, you know, the first answer is what's it for is, you know, they're not selling cars. So their top line is down. They don't have money coming in. They still have all this fixed cost going out. So they have to pay the bills. In fact, I know they were very close on making payroll in 2008. Sorry. So I think some of the bailout is going to come just to make ends meet until they can put some more aggressive cost-saving actions in place. Okay.
Yeah.
Or start selling vehicles again, which personally I don't think is going to happen real quickly. So they need to slash their costs. Okay. They asked for 34, 35. They got 17.4. I think it was a prudent move by the government to do that. There's I think one of the things we had talked about is, you know, capitalism. Okay. I'm a capitalist. I 100% believe that a company should be able to succeed without government intervention and should be able to fail without government intervention. But I think in this specific case, they really, the government, had to look at the global marketplace and understand what is our competition doing, okay, different from us. In Japan, you have the Keiretsu system. You probably heard of it, right? It's where the companies like Toyota, they basically work very closely with, if not part of, a bank. So their ability to secure funds quickly, capital, working capital quickly, they can do it much easier, much faster than the big three can. Okay. I don't know, because I'm not an expert in this area, but I don't know just how ingrained they are with the government of Japan. But they're certainly closer than we are in the United States.
Yeah.
So I think you have to look at, okay, what are we competing against, all right? And so that has to be taken into account. Certainly the auto companies in China, which aren't yet a major threat in the United States, but certainly in the Pacific Rim, in the Chinese home market, and in Japan, they're major threats. Those are government-owned entities, so they are fully supported by their government. So it's a very difficult position where, you know, personally, I was very concerned to see the government stepping in any bailouts, whether it's the financial $700 billion or the automotive, which is going to come out of the $700 billion. I really don't like to see government intervention. But in this case, you have to look at, or they have to at least consider leveling the playing field for the big three, demanding that they make changes so they are sustainable on their own without further support. But I think they also have to look at what would be the ramifications if these companies failed.
And that whole idea of too big to fail, that a company is too big to fail. We've heard a lot about that recently. And is this an example of that?
I think it's an example of it. If one of them fails, what it will do to affect the rest of the industry is they all have shared suppliers. Okay. So many, many companies rely on all three of them. My last job, where it was a tier one supplier, we supplied Ford, General Motors, and Toyota. Okay. A little bit of Chrysler, not much. If we had lost one of those accounts, it could have potentially put us into I don't know if it pushed us into bankruptcy, but certainly in a temporary insolvent position. Okay. They're already experiencing suppliers that have had to close their doors or go into bankruptcy. And that's the trickle-down effect where, let's say Chrysler goes into bankruptcy, just closes their door tomorrow. Okay, that's fine and dandy for Chrysler, but it's the rest of the suppliers that then may not be able to keep their doors open to support General Motors and Ford, plus Toyota and others, quite frankly, that produce here in the United States.
Right, right.
So that's the trickle-down effect where they're really looking at it like, this really could drive a huge domino effect that could cause a major collapse in the U.S. economy. So they're walking a very thin line, you know. Who knows the right answer? I think they did a prudent thing. They put a stopgap, a Band-Aid on the situation, and then demanded that by, I think it's March 1st or March 31st, that they deliver some very detailed plans and they have an outline of the concessions that they expect to see. Things like renegotiated union contracts that help reduce the variable costs of labor.
Which, in your opinion, I don't want to speak for you, but that's long overdue.
Long overdue, yeah. Absolutely. A couple examples. You know, we have facilities, my current company, any company I've worked for, we've had facilities overseas and in Mexico and in South America. Typically, those are there to support those local markets, okay? But their labor cost definitely is lower. No doubt about it, it's lower. Something we'll talk a little bit more about, too, I think, is the corporate tax structure, which it may be an even greater player than the labor rates that we see in these other...
And what do you mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, in the United States, we pay just about 40% of our corporate income taxes. That's the level based on our profits or EBITDA, okay? So let's just say profits. I pay 40%. I make $1 million. I give $400,000 to the government.
Okay.
If you go to the Czech Republic, you're paying about 16%. So 40% to 16%. If you go to Ireland, you're paying, I think it's 11%. Okay. Now you have to look at the labor rates too. Ireland's very high. You know, England, very high. They have very strict labor laws. But not so in the Czech Republic and some of the other countries where the labor rates are much lower than the United States and their tax structure is astoundingly lower than the United States. Give you a couple examples. The last, I'm basically run plants. The last two companies I've been with, the labor portion of the business has been about 20% of our overall costs. 20% versus 40% on the income tax. So what's a bigger driver to move product overseas? Okay. You would at least say they're considered equally. If not, the tax structure may actually be more important. So Singapore was offering an incentive. If you move a new facility to Singapore, you pay zero taxes for 10 years. I mean, you know.
It's enticing, isn't it?
Right. And even when the 10 years expires, they were at about a 10% corporate tax rate versus 39.6% in the U.S.
We're talking with Chris McHugh. He's a former executive at Ford and GM, giving us perspective on the bailout. If you've got a question or a comment for Chris, give us a call, 977-1070. What are your thoughts about this bailout? You think it's going to work? Chris, you're talking about opening facilities in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a little bit, if you can, about this whole idea, the manufacturing in America and how we've lost so much of this manufacturing. And I happen to believe, I'm one of those people that believes a country is strong to the extent to which it makes stuff. And when you stop making stuff, how can you be a strong country when you're just buying stuff or on credit or flipping burgers or working in a hotel? You can't have a strong country that's just a, a service industry, can you?
I agree completely. It concerns me deeply. The trend that we've seen over the last 20 or 30 years of jobs basically leaving the country. A lot of that is due to the tax structure that I mentioned. It's not so much a question of are companies disloyal to the United States or they don't care about the American workers. But the fact of the matter is these companies are publicly traded. They are there to make money for themselves and for the stockholders. And so if they consider facilities in other countries that have a labor rate that's, you know, half, a quarter, 10% of the U.S. and a tax rate that's half of the U.S., they need to strongly consider doing so. If they don't, they cannot be competitive in a global market. Global market cuts both ways. We have the Walmarts, right, where we import all these goods and the consumer chooses to go and buy from Walmart.
Yeah.
But how many products are made in the United States in Walmart? Very few.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, we're shipping trees to China so they can turn it into furniture,
right,
to ship it back and put it in a Walmart.
Right. So it's a double-edged sword no matter how you – the consumer is not innocent here. Okay. We all can make those choices. Government has parts as well. Ford, GM, Chrysler management has their part that they've played as well.
Yeah.
So
Chris McHugh is a former executive at Ford. Chris, tell us exactly now – what needs to be fixed? And is it fixable with the auto industry in America? It looks like we might lose Chrysler, mm-hmm, might be subsumed by one of the other two. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. I think we have three companies that basically build a very similar product when you look at it on a global scale.
Yeah.
Okay, SUVs, the minivans, larger vehicles. We have three companies that make that. I don't think we have the market share anymore to support three companies. You look back in the 70s, the big three had well over 90% share of the U.S. North American market. Today, it's well under 50%.
Wow.
They have not been able to consolidate their operations to keep pace with the loss of market share. Okay? So that's one of the big problems that we had talked about. Their fixed base,
yeah,
their capacity, their footprint for manufacturing in the United States is too big.
They have these huge factories, mm-hmm, that once upon a time made a bunch of cars. Well, now they're not making as many cars,
right,
almost half as less, but they still have the big factories.
Right. These plants were built typically 1970s or earlier, and they were geared up for we're at 15 million, let's say, units on average this year. We had 90% of that. Now we have 40%, 50%, somewhere much lower than 50%. So we have a lot of these factories that are sitting running one shift, maybe two. I can't believe it today. It's probably all one shift, which,
yeah,
means you just can't pay the bills, the fixed costs, the utilities, the rent, the taxes on those facilities when you're running one shift operations out of them. They just can't pay for themselves. So what has to happen is they do have to do a massive consolidation of their facilities, and that's going to be difficult because they have to deal with the UAW. They have to negotiate plant closures. This is where I actually wanted to see bankruptcy actions, because when that occurs, then the restructuring is much easier. Delphi, they went through restructuring bankruptcy just a few years ago. They're still in business today, right? They didn't disappear off the face of the planet. They're still here. That's what some of these other companies really need to do. I think the 17.4 million is a stop, or a billion is a stopgap.
But we still might see bankruptcy.
We still might see bankruptcy.
And if I hear you right, that actually might be a good thing, because it will bring the unions back to the table and you write all new contracts and the company says, look, if you want America to have a solvent auto industry, then we need to have a different relationship with the unions.
Absolutely. That has to happen, whether it's in bankruptcy, restructuring, or just because Congress is saying, hey, show me a plan.
Yeah.
My suspicion is they're going to come to Congress with a plan. It's going to be 20%, 30% of what it really needs to be. I mean, we need to see some massive changes in how we operate these companies.
So what happens? What needs to happen? We're talking with Chris McHugh, a former executive at Ford. What do we need to do? What really needs to happen, 1, 2, 3, so that we can have a successful auto industry, you think?
Okay, number one, you got to get the variable costs down. You've got to get the labor rates more in line with a global scale. We're not saying, you know, we want to pay people minimum wage, but on the other hand, they can't be paid $40, $50 an hour. I mean, it just can't support that anymore. So bring it in line with the rest of the country, with the rest of manufacturing in the United States, okay? That'd be the first step. So maybe a 50% reduction in variable costs. I'll just throw that out there.
Yeah.
Fixed cost, another 50%, maybe more, needs to be reduced in the United States. Now that's
and that's like your cost of your footprint, electricity,
yeah.
How to heat a factory. These, yeah.
Yeah, that's like I have 50 plants and I really can fill up 20. So I'm paying the rent and the land and the taxes and utilities and to maintain these facilities. This is not a house. These are major manufacturing facilities that have very costly utilities and piping and 480 electricity. And, you know, there's always something that goes wrong. So yeah. You need a major crew to take care of it all the time. And so that's something I think that's overlooked a lot is the facilities costs. It's like if you or I bought a second house and we never went there.
Right.
You still have to maintain this house or it's going to fall apart.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what the big three are doing now. With these empty factories or these little used factories that they have.
Yeah, instead of closing them because they have union contracts binding them to keep them open. We even had some facilities that have a limit on the number of bargaining unit employees at the facility. So you could cut only down to some minimal level. So you could potentially cut it down to a skeleton crew, but that's it. You still got to keep the plant open and those people employed. When maybe the right move is to close it altogether.
From a business perspective,
yes.
Your MBA degree is saying we got to close this facility and consolidate, and the unions are saying you have an agreement with us where you have to keep this plant open.
Right. So, the industry can be fixed. There's no doubt in my mind it can be fixed. You truly have, and I know it has somewhat of a bad reputation in other parts of the country, but you have some brilliant minds that work at those companies, but their hands are tied. And this is where I like the intervention in this case where the government is demanding, show us a plan. And if you can't show us a plan, then you're probably going to have to go into bankruptcy. And then we're going to be involved from that point of view as well.
Yeah, which the Democrats in Washington don't want to see happen. I'm speaking in stereotypes here, but they don't want to see the unions lose the contracts they have, right?
Well, yes, that's true. Yeah, the political side of it. That enters, that's going to pose some difficulties. But what's got to happen is the fixed costs got to be reduced, so the number of plants has to be cut down. Not just the plants, but the corporate structures as well. I mean, where you have literally hundreds, if not thousands, of employees supporting the engineering, new product development, logistics, all of that needs to be.
You don't need as many people.
No.
Yeah. We're talking with Chris McHugh, a former executive at Ford, honored to have him in the studio. Margo's been waiting patiently on line one. Margo, you're on with Chris. Go right ahead.
Hi, I have two questions. The first one is, I don't hear about any of these executives being replaced by, let's say, more creative thinking people. and secondly, I understand that I've heard that cars, the American cars, do well in Europe. If so, are they made in Europe, and why can't they bring that success here?
Two great questions. Margo, thank you so much for the call. Appreciate it. Good questions. I've heard the same thing, that some of these American cars sell great overseas.
They do, because, again, the big three, they have look, we build the best trucks and SUVs in the world, bar none. Okay, so in those markets, which are more of a niche market, they're less a commodity market in Europe because, the roads are small and the fuel is much more expensive.
Yeah.
So people don't generally buy pickup trucks and SUVs to drive for pleasure. It's more of
But for somebody that vehicle. Does need a pickup truck in Switzerland, they're going to want a Ford.
Yeah. And they're built, but they are built over in Europe. I mean, Ford has plants in England and all throughout Europe to supply the European demand, and into the old Soviet bloc countries.
Right. So it's more of these niche cars that are selling well overseas versus a family four-door.
Yeah. The problem is not in Europe or Asia. It's in North America is the problem because the Ford and GM are rightly sized in Asia, in Europe, and South America. They have facilities. They have state-of-the-art facilities in these countries, which are much more efficient. They're non-union, or the unions are different. The German union is it's part of the government. These folks are experts, okay? I dealt a lot with the unions in Germany. Most of those folks have what we would call a bachelor's degree here in the United States. They are professionals, and they take great pride in their work.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a different culture, and that's why I'm saying in North America, it's a different culture. Okay. So yeah, what the nice lady said was
Margo,
true.
Yeah.
Margo.
About, what about executives?
Well, I think she has an excellent point, and that is, look, we have a team of folks that have led these companies down this path. They didn't get here overnight, okay? So they need some fresh blood to come in and say, okay, guys, we need to change some things. And the problem in that culture is it's so ingrained and the companies are so big, it's like steering the Titanic.
Yeah.
Very difficult to make change, especially when your hands are tied with the contracts. Or, you know, quite frankly, if you got a new CEO in one of these companies, you still have an old board, you still have middle management that's been doing it this way for 30 years or more. It's going to be a very tough road to change this culture. Anyone that's worked in manufacturing and knows, if you have to make a cultural change, that's the most difficult change to make, bar none. So,
because you have so many people who've well, we've been coming to work for years, and this is the way we do it. And you're asking me to do it a different way.
Right.
I don't know that.
Right.
And people get scared of change. Yeah.
Yeah. All the way from the manufacturing floor, where they need to adopt the lean principles, lean manufacturing concepts that are simply elimination of waste. But that same methodology and mentality needs to be carried all the way up to the CEOs of these corporations. You know, Ford at one point, I haven't checked their annual report lately, but they had nearly 200 vice presidents.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, these guys aren't making 60 grand a year. Okay. These guys are millionaires.
Yeah.
And there's 200 of them. Do you really need 200 vice presidents to manage this company? I don't think so. So I think that's a very valid point. You need some people with fresh perspective and a sense of urgency to come into these companies and say, hey, what we've done doesn't work. We need to do something different. You know.
Yeah.
It's
and what are the chances? Got about a minute or two left. What are the chances that's going to happen, number one? And number two, what do you think is really going to happen?
Chances of it's not going to happen. Okay. I don't think that they're going to get the change that they need in the management team unless it's mandated somehow. So what's going to happen is Chrysler is going to either be sold or go into bankruptcy. Obviously, their parent company has the cash but is not willing to put it into the corporation. I think not only will that happen, I think it needs to happen. And then you've got two companies that will compete, and with some restructuring, hopefully with the UAW sitting at the table, they can make it work.
And hopefully they can make a product that, what American wouldn't love to buy an American car if they knew that it wasn't going to fall apart in 4 years, I mean, we'd all love to go buy a Ford if we knew this is going to be a great car for the next 15 years.
Exactly. They not only do they have to get the quality up, but now they have to overcome the perception of inferior quality.
Yeah.
That's the big trick.
Chris McHugh is a former executive at Ford and GM. It's been an honor to have you here, Chris. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Coy.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit seavillepodcast.com for more.